we talked about the rise of disability and the way in which that identity can get a certain kind of benefit or a certain kind of support from society. And I guess there's this question I still have about, what about people, what do we do socially if we don't have something like the DSM? How do we address the fact that there are so many people who are really genuinely struggling, just really trying to make it, trying to put it together, trying to get their lives happening, and they just continue to have huge, huge difficulties, and then the appeal of something like a psychiatric diagnosis to lift that burden of responsibility, that sense of shame and guilt, like, this is my fault, there's something wrong with me, I'm not trying hard enough, or how do we respond to those people if we're not embracing this idea that we can simply analyze them from a psychological and a biological deficit standpoint and then say, okay, this is your disorder, this is why you're not able to succeed?
I'm not sure that the original purpose of the DSM, or even the major purpose of the DSM, is to give people that identity. In fact, I know it isn't, because really clear that that's not how the psychiatrists who write the book think about it. So in a way, what you're talking about is an accidental outcome. So the question really is there a more intentional way? If the object of the game isn't to treat or to count or to segregate, which are some of the traditional reasons for diagnosis, if the object of the game is to give people what you just talked about, then I suppose what you have to do is you have to create in society more mechanisms of acceptance. Really, the idea that the label gives you that, when it isn't stigmatizing you, that it gives you those social resources, that is sort of a sad commentary on how we distribute social resources like money and sympathy. It's too bad that we require that. And when it comes to specifically DSM, we're all enthralled to this idea that suffering is the result of something that medicine can treat. That's an idea we come by honestly because medicine has figured out how to treat an awful lot of suffering. But the idea that all our suffering can be found in biological pathologies that can be targeted with magic bullet drugs and treated, that's ultimately a very oppressive idea, and it's a very limited idea. So I don't really have a solution to this problem, but I would say that at the very least, it requires looking at medicine in a much more limited context. There's some things medicine's really good at and some things it's not very good at.
One of the things that we hear a lot about these days is the idea of evidence-based practice, that if someone is suffering, if someone has problems with attention or with depression or with anxiety, or they're hearing voices, or they're having some difficulty that might be considered psychological, that, well, there's a lot of different treatments out there, and you know, some of them are really kind of not very effective, but we want to have these evidence-based treatments. We want to be able to show that something like cognitive behavioral therapy actually does work, and therefore that's why we're going to fund it as a society. And you've written quite eloquently about the problems of looking for an evidence-based solution to what it is that can actually help people. Tell us some more about that.
The evidence-based medicine in general is an attempt to establish accountability. And there's nothing wrong with that. I actually think that when it comes to mental health treatment, that evidence-based medicine is just the price that we, and I mean by we mental health people, clinicians, pay for having climbed into bed with medicine in the first place. It's sort of, if you think of evidence-based medicine, it's our bastard offspring of having, you know, gotten in bed with medicine. So I want to preface everything that I say by saying I understand why that's necessary if it's necessary to have healthcare dollars responsible for our mental health. I'm not sure that's such a great idea to begin with. But if indeed it is, then what you have to do is you do have to establish outcomes and ways to evaluate them. And what you end up with are these very superficial, ideologically naive outcomes, goals that you have to treat toward. And you end up making psychotherapy and the understanding of the human that's behind psychotherapy superficial. You end up making it very medicalized. You end up circumventing the whole, when it comes to actual mental health treatment, you end up circumventing the relationship between the therapist and the client, which is actually the heart of psychotherapy. So when it comes to therapy, to subject it to evidence-based medicine, it's like trying to pour old wine into a new skin. I don't think it's going to work. unless you change the very definition of what you're trying to do.
So, Gary, you're a practicing therapist, and you described yourself as being more on the side of seeing psychotherapy as an art form, and not so much as this kind of DSM-oriented scientific objectivity endeavor. Tell us about what is your vision of how we should be responding to human suffering, and how we should consider the mind and the heart and people's efforts to try and live a good life or deal with the experiences that they're going through that are emotionally painful or emotionally difficult.
Well, therapy is what we have left now that religion has been more or less obliterated. And so in some ways it's one of the things that we have left. And in some ways you have to look at it as sort of what we're stuck with and make the most of it. So to me, what therapy does is intimately tied to the way our society is organized. What therapy does is it provides the opportunity for people to sit down and focus on questions that otherwise we don't have the time, the energy, or the inclination to focus on. Like, what's the meaning and purpose of a life? Why do I treat people in the way that I do? How should I treat people? How should I treat myself? What should my relationship be with the rest of my society? And so on. And to me, the basis of that relationship is the relationship. It's what happens in that very intimate setting of an hour looking at each other and talking to each other. It's actually not that complicated. Now, does any of that have anything to do with healthcare? I really don't know. The fact that I'm able to charge $140 an hour for my time. Well, in part, that's because there's insurance out there and it will pay me if I just will essentially lie and write down a psychiatric diagnosis. In part, it's the result of my being able to see relatively affluent people. And in part, it's the result of my what I do being difficult and recognized as difficult. But I could do it, and I do it often for less money than that. If somebody can't afford to pay me the full freight, I just had an example. A guy came to see me and he needs to be treated in his own view for anxiety. He's a real crossroads in his life. He's not sure of himself. He has trouble establishing relationships. He doesn't really know what to do next. And he has a security clearance. Well, I explained to him, if you use your insurance to pay for this, they're going to raise questions the next time you go to renew your security clearance, or if you try to upgrade it. Now, those questions may or may not be innocuous, but the fact of the matter is, he decided he doesn't want to use his insurance. Well, in return for that, I give him a big discount. I say, well, what can you afford? And the guy's making good money, so he can afford to pay me $100 an hour. I think of it like a car payment. This is what it's going to cost you. Sort of like if you can afford to drive a BMW, you're paying me BMW money. If all you can afford is a Kia, then pay me Kia money, you know? So, that's the money side of it. The relationship is established, and then this whole superstructure of finance and insurance and all that is imposed on it. If you eliminate that, then what you have is essentially the relationship that ministers or rabbis or priests or whatever used to have with their parishioners. Somebody that you can go to and sort of pour your heart out to. And get back in return acceptance and understanding and insight and possibly even correction.
And I guess the huge difference is that when you go to a minister, their value system, their morals, their theological, spiritual beliefs are like right there on the table. But the psychotherapist often stands in this place of objectivity and common sense and science and medicine. And so there isn't actual a recognition of the value and the morality that's at play in that relationship.
That's exactly right. The ideology is concealed unless the therapist chooses for it not to be, which I do. I mean, of course, I tell people what I believe. And, I don't try to tell them, look, this isn't healthy for you to do. I say that once in a while if I really believe it. But I'm pretty careful to tell people that this is what I believe and this is where my reaction is coming from. And sometimes it's only a belief that you have to be accountable for how you come across to others. And sometimes it's a belief about how we ought to act in the world in general. So, but you're correct that in general, psychotherapy's ideology is concealed and it may differ vastly from one therapist to another. when therapists rely on medicine or science to sort of take that whole question off the table. Well, I'm a practitioner of a scientific practice here. I think they're doing everybody a disservice.
One of the things that we're seeing with the DSM-5 is this eruption of this huge battle, this war inside the politics of it, with some of the real promoters of the DSM now questioning some of the things that they've been promoting. And what do you see the future of the DSM as? Where is psychiatry headed? Because the battles that have emerged with the DSM-5 have been really huge, and they've been quite public, and there's more of a greater recognition now, I think, that this is a political document, not just a scientific document.
I think actually that the extent of controversy over the DSM is not necessarily going to clue the general public into how political the document is, at least not in a larger sense. It will be very clear to people when they read my book or the other stuff that's going to get written about the DSM that there are politics that take place, that all the politicking that goes on behind the scenes to create the disorders and the criteria. But the big picture politics, the ones whereby the DSM becomes a moral document, I think that's going to stay pretty hidden. I also think that these wars may end up only suggesting that this particular crew of psychiatrists who created the DSM-5 are a uniquely incompetent bunch, which they are. I mean, I have to admit that while I don't believe that that is the entire explanation for what went wrong, the stupidity and the incompetence and the outright idiocy of some of the things that they did is astonishing.
Give us a couple of examples of that, Gary, because I know there's some pretty serious stories out there.
This whole business with eliminating the bereavement exclusion. There's an exclusion in the DSM-4 for the depression diagnosis because so many people who are grieving meet the criteria for depression. There's an exclusion that says you have to, if a clinician can't diagnose depression if a person has been recently bereaved within 2 months. They're taking that out. Now, I could go into the story of why that's happening, but just on the face of it, how stupid is that? They're going to turn around with a public that's already skeptical of psychiatry and say, okay, you lost your wife, and after 2 weeks, if you meet the criteria for major depression, you have a mental disorder? I mean, why would you do that? There's nothing to stop a doctor from providing medication to a person whose wife died yesterday, let alone 2 weeks ago, if they feel that their patient is, and the patient wants it, and they, you know, whatever. That's the doctor's role. You don't need a diagnosis of depression to do that. 72% of antidepressant prescriptions are written without a diagnosis. So the only thing that they're doing there is they're getting rid of an embarrassing thing, because if you put that exclusion into the DSM in the first place, then people will and have raised the question, well, what about unemployment? What about foreclosure? What about something, divorce? And the answer to that question is there's no reason not to have those other stressors in there. And they can't go back to the old days when they cared about why you had your mental disorder. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, but they should have left it alone, because the solution is worse than the problem. Okay, so that's an example.
What's another example? That's a great example.
Another example would be, and this isn't about a diagnosis, this is how they handled the fact that I was writing this book. They decided early on in the process of my writing this book that they weren't going to provide me with any information. Now, anybody knows that if somebody's writing a book about you, you not only provide them with information, you sandbag them. You fight about everything. You do everything you can to spin, to alter, to get your voice into that person's book. And indeed, most of what they could have told me, I just had to look a little harder to find. It's not like there's no long public record of psychiatry out there. And so they decided at an institutional level that the way to deal with this was to not deal with me at all. Even the Church of Scientology, their arch enemy, this is interesting, their arch enemy, the Church of Scientology, worked very hard with Larry Wright, who just wrote that expose about Scientology, to control what he was trying to say. So that's just an example of the kind of whatever it is thinking, it's sort of hostile, paranoid thinking that goes on at an institutional level.
Is there another quick example about some of the stupid things that the DSM is going to be presenting us with?
The decision to remove Asperger's was poorly considered because of what I mentioned before, which is that they didn't take into account that people would be upset that they would lose their identities. Now, how could they not know that? So I, you know, I just think there are a million examples. And in fact, Alan Francis, the former editor of the guy who did the DSM-IV, this has been his critique. His critique is not a critique of psychiatry at all. He's still a big defender of psychiatry or the DSM. He's a big defender of the DSM. He should be. He wrote one, right? But his critique has been these guys don't know what they're doing. He calls them the Keystone Cops. And there's something wrong with that critique, too, because it misses the point, which is that the problem isn't just that these guys are incompetent. It's also that they're trying to do something that is probably impossible and is certainly not something that should be done, which is they're trying to turn human suffering into a series of medical disorders. And that, of course, is the big historical problem with psychiatry. And it's been, you know, psychiatry's been bemoaning its difficulty in diagnosing mental illness for at least 100 years. This is not the first time they've had to grapple with this. Mm-hmm. And they understand that without a coherent diagnostic system, they're not going to have much respect. And so it becomes really incumbent upon them to fashion one. And that's what they've been trying to do since at least 1880.
Gary, we're just about out of time with the interview. Tell us again the name of your book that's coming out and also how people can get in touch with you if they want to find out more information about manufacturing depression, your other book, and your writings and your work.
My most recent book is The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. It's an account of the making of the DSM-5 in its historical context. And everything that I've written, more or less, is on my website, which is GaryGreenbergOnline.com, and my books can be ordered there too.
And many thanks to Madness Radio for making that podcast available. If you seek them out at madnessradio.org, you'll find a bunch more similar podcasts also available for download. Now we return to Tony Wright, whom we first heard in episode 652, Are We in Our Right Minds? This is from July 2009 by Radio New Zealand.
We spoke to our first guest of the week, Tony Wright, a few years ago. Tony had just set a world record for the longest period of unbroken consciousness, that is, he'd stayed awake for 266 hours. He was doing it to demonstrate his theories on human brain functional or dysfunction. Tony's theory is that changes in diet, some thousands of years ago, led to the left hemisphere of our brains dominating our thinking. We became more rational, perhaps, but less brilliant and possibly more fearful. We promised ourselves we'd catch up with Tony Wright at some point to see how his theories have progressed. And Tony joins us now on the phone from Cornwall in England. Welcome back to tonight's, Tony.
Morning. How
are Sounds you? Like my left brain's already struggling.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It can get a bit like that.
Now, actually, I was just checking on that world record. Is it still a world record?
Well, there was an awful lot of press at the time, and various stories were sort of touted around. Was it the right record? All that kind of thing. And to be quite honest, there were other claimants to the record I knew at the time. But I was particularly interested in Randy Gardner's record because it was so well known. And at the time, he was 17, and I was in my 40s. And I thought it would be a good contrast, really, whether an old guy like me could sort of managed to do what he'd done with relative ease. So basically, I wanted to break his record, and I did.
Yeah, because it was 264 hours for Randy Gardner.
That's right. Yeah, I went a couple of more hours than he went, and that was my objective. But I was aware there were other claimants.
Some bloke from Finland. Some bloke from Finland.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. You see, they just weren't really well known at all, whereas there were sort of accounts of Randy Gardner's record and how he struggled from day two or day three. So that was my objective, really, was to demonstrate relative ease, whereas absolute records, I mean, there were claims sort of 400 hours plus, all sorts of things. So I wasn't so interested in that. It was more of a PR stunt, to be quite honest.
Yeah, and that when I was looking back, because I wanted to check on your record before I spoke to you tonight, and I looked at a website and said that the Guinness removed this Finnish guy, Tony Soini, from Hamina in Finland.
Yeah.
He stayed awake for 276 hours, and they removed it or deleted the record on the grounds that it could encourage records harmful to health.
That's
and was
right,
unverifiable
yeah.
because of the claims of insomnia. sufferers. But that's the whole thing. Now, staying awake for a long time, they removed it because they didn't want to encourage more people to do it. Now, you had a particular reason for doing it, and I'd like you to remind us of that now.
Well, it was born out of some of my early health experiments going back to the mid-90s, where I became interested in all sorts of ancient traditions as to how you can access more function, really, a better state of mind. And some of them sound very contradictory. I mean, there's some of the classic ones that you can use drugs. Well, we all know that drugs can be very dangerous. On the other hand, there are living traditions that seem to use drugs very sensibly, and they don't have any problems. Then there were techniques to do with, you know, breathing, yoga, meditation, the kind of things people have heard of. But there was also this sleep deprivation thing which kept cropping up and still exists today in some cultures, sort of vision quest and breaking your sleep to prayer, this kind of thing. So that was kind of where part of my interest came from. And once I started doing some experiments, I was quite astounded at what happened, really.
You were trying to break the grip that the left side of the brain has on our consciousness,
weren't you? That's the idea, yes. The idea, I mean, this is quite a wide context to this, as you know, but the basic idea is that the side of our brain that runs the show, that we feel our normal selves in, if you like, because it's not as functional as we think, this is according to my theory, its batteries aren't as strong, if you like. So you stay awake, and yes, you get tired, you get irritable, you get clumsy, your speech slurs, all the classic things. But if you push it far enough, its ability to stay in charge also weakens. So there's the paradox. Eventually, if you do the right preparation, you start breaking through into this other space, shall we call it, where things feel phenomenally better, and the tiredness actually goes away, which, you know, is a major shock to most people.
What were some of your experiences during that record-breaking or record-setting attempt?
There were hints of what had happened before. I mean, it was a very different situation. In the past, I did quite a lot of staying awake, I think up to about 7 or 8 days in the past, really to sort of test this idea, and I think the repetition was important as well. It's sort of you become familiar with the process and you know what's going to happen and so on. Whereas on the record attempt, it was intentionally to draw interest to the idea, so I was really looking to stay as normal as I possibly could, if you like. So really, I certainly felt periods of extreme relaxation. The tiredness would disappear for hours on end. I was playing pool a lot, simply to, you know, while away the hours in the night time. And there were periods where I think there were people coming in to beat the guy who was staying awake, and they were leaving after 10, 12 games had been crushed, sort of thing. So it was quite an interesting bunch of stuff going on where the apparent dysfunction people would expect simply wasn't there.
I was thinking of your ideas, your theories recently. Have you heard of the woman Jill Bolte Taylor, who had the stroke?
I've had a little bit of correspondence.
Yes, I was going to ask you whether you'd spoken to her.
Not spoken, mostly email correspondence. That's sort of the easiest way I find to get in touch with people.
This is the woman, by the way, if you don't know. She had a stroke and it knocked out the left hemisphere of her brain and left only the right hemisphere functional. And she seemed to have experiences of bliss, of connectedness, and some brilliance as well, along with the fact that she struggled to communicate and struggled to write and things like that.
She sort of had those classic mystical type experiences, a sort of profound sense of self and all sorts of things going on. But as you say, she struggled then to do some very basic things. And I found that exactly as I would expect, where you have a structural damage that suddenly releases that function, but it's been locked away for a lifetime. And the other thing I've talked about in the past is diet and biochemistry. And without the appropriate fuels and preparation, you end up accessing something that's still very dormant. It feels profound, it feels amazing, but it's not fully engaged. And I'm pretty sure that's what she experienced. And the presumption is, well, that's the way it is. We have this specialization where we have the rational mind to do all these things. And then, if we're lucky, we can glimpse this other side of the coin. If that sort of fits the pattern, it's something we can dip into rather than we can be functional ill.
Yes, I mean, there are literally two sides to your theory. One is that the dysfunctional left side is dominating our thinking. The other part of that theory is that the right hemisphere of the brain is inherently more brilliant than the left side, right?
Yeah.
What have you been doing since we last spoke to you? It's what, 2 or 3 years now? So you've had a bit of time to work on this
years,
stuff.
Well, the main focus has been, and the sleep event was really around that, is trying to communicate these ideas, the theory. It's a fairly complete theory now. It has been since about 1998, primarily because it could be of major fundamental importance if our neurological system isn't as functional as we think, if that's driving our behavior, our thoughts, our psychology, and the world we create. And let's face it, it's not difficult to find evidence of humans behaving a bit strangely and a bit crazily. It could take us to a causality that's pretty much been missed in modern science, where, well, actually, if the structure of our brain doesn't develop properly, of course we're going to have endless problems perceiving reality, diagnosing what's going on, and coming up with appropriate responses. And clearly we don't do that. You know, we're in a terrible mess.
Your attempt to explain what happened with the left hemisphere and why it became so dominant, when we last spoke to you, at its core was diet. Is that still the case?
Yes, although the emphasis is on the hormonal effect of our ancestral diet. And bearing in mind, most of the components are pretty much accepted anyway. All I've really done is join the dots, if you like, just put them in a different context. And it's pretty much accepted, depending on your tradition or your belief system or whatever, but certainly the modern science approach is that we spent great periods of our evolution in the tropical forest eating a diet that was very rich in a class of compounds that are now generally considered, they're called endocrine disruptors. They disrupt our hormonal system, and they're generally considered potentially dangerous, yet the paradox is they were present during our developmental period for millions and millions of years. They affected the way the brain developed, its structure, its function. And they've gone AWOL now. They're not there anymore. So that's the kind of basic query I've brought up, is, well, if these chemicals were there, they must have affected our brain. And as you know, there are quite a lot of mysteries around the human brain, why it got so big so quickly, why it stopped expanding and so on. And if they were there, now they're not. Of course, that will have affected structure in a different way. And we have bits of evidence, for example, there's research going on in Cambridge and I think other parts of the world that's building a compelling case that the left side of our brain doesn't develop properly. This is accepted. This is in the literature. It's not just some fanciful notion. And the reasons for that are a class of chemicals we produce ourselves, our own sex hormones, things like estrogen and testosterone. And they seem to inhibit the development, change the structure. And the class of compounds I'm interested in our ancestral diet, they affect our own hormones. So you have this antagonism that was going on in our evolutionary past, and it's not there anymore. So the question arises, should our left hemisphere be retarded? Should its development be retarded? Or do we just accept that and go merrily on our way?
Is it simply a case that we stopped eating certain things, or was it other things that came into our diet, such as more meat? Maybe we started eating grains?
Yeah, I think the primary effect was the loss of these chemicals. They're called flavonoids, the sort of give the coloration to things, particularly fruit, you know, thousands of different chemicals that give it the reds and the yellows and so on. I think that was the primary effect, the loss of these chemicals. I think the addition of less helpful dietary elements certainly compounded the issue, particularly in more recent times, but my main interest is the loss of these chemicals because they're so powerful. They affect development in the uterus and they affect real-time functioning. They're kind of like a class of mild drugs that have effects on the way our brain develops. So, yeah, very powerful.
I remember reading your book, Left in the Dark, and I think you used this a sort of biblical imagery. We went out of the Garden of Eden, we were eating all these nice things in the forest, and then for some reason we left the forest, and that's what the Fall of Eden's all about.
Well, yeah, I sort of wove some of that in. I wanted to build a rational case and draw on evidence that exists in modern science, and I think that would have to be there in abundance. You can't come along and claim that our brain is effectively retarded and damaged if there isn't a huge amount of evidence. It's whether the question's ever being asked, and I think there is evidence, of course. I outline a lot of it in the book. However, I also wanted to at least draw attention to the traditions that have been handed down to us, however dogmatic or distorted some of them have become, they almost all speak with the same voice, that something went amiss and our perceptions become limited, we've become deluded, and we don't live in the way we used to. And you know, it's become a very degenerative process, really. Our history has been a process of slow degeneration, and all the traditions more or less say that. And, of course, the Garden of Eden is a classic, if somewhat simplified, example.
Yeah, mind you, and I don't want to dwell on this for too long, but it was eating the apple that got us into trouble.
Whereas yeah,
in your case,
well,
it's stopping eating it that's perhaps
the thing.
I don't
claim to be an expert on symbolism and how the micro detail of all this works. I mean, I know a lot of these texts probably came from oral traditions, at least some of them did, and even the written traditions that were translated from Aramaic to Greek to Latin to English. So I'm not going to pretend to comment on the minute detail. I just say that the general plot seems to be not just in the Christian tradition, but in all the major traditions, that there's hints of forest dwelling, fruit eating, and living in a sort of benign and state of perpetual wonder almost, where things like anger and warfare just weren't part of the equation, and that changed, and we ended up, you know, tilling the soil, obviously to feed ourselves, and things got slowly worse, and we ended up where we are now. So, I mean, it's more of a general feel rather than any particular detail.
Since we spoke to you last, Tony, have you done some research? Because one of the things that questions that occurred to me then was, if it's diet that impacted on our brain's development all those thousands of years ago, can we to some extent reclaim our minds through what we eat now?
Yeah, I mean, this question crops up a lot, understandably, and I think to some degree the answer is yes, and again, an awful lot of evidence, whether it be from the limited research that's gone on into nutrition. I mean, humans are treated as if we're somehow different to all other species. You know, if you went to a safari park or a zoo or a research center, they treat the primates as if they're primates, whereas we seem to have a wholly different set of rules. So what's acceptable for us to eat bears no relationship to any other, what any other animal eats. And the little bit of research that has been done does suggest that what we're doing isn't at all healthy. I think even the official sort of statistics on cancer suggest that 40% plus is caused by diet. So, yeah, I mean, a huge amount of pain and suffering from a diet that we know isn't healthy for us. So I think, yeah, there's a lot of scope there to improve things. One of the challenges which I point out in the book is that because we're running on the left side of our brain, which is pretty much accepted, it's dominant, it's in charge, it doesn't run our hormone system very well. And even putting the dietary elements back in, it's still a limiting factor. You almost have to find a way to improve your diet and find a way to reduce the effects of the left hemisphere, and that's a little bit more tricky. But then that's what the practices were, and I emphasize practices rather than the teachings of or the beliefs, but the practices of many spiritual traditions. They were using techniques to try and shift dominance, so meditation, not talking, staying awake, using chemicals that mimic the chemistry in our brain, this kind of stuff, trying to shift the balance. And they also talk about natural diets. So it's nothing new. I've just tried to put it in a modern format that's a bit more accessible.
You're organising a symposium on the theory, aren't you?
Yes. The idea is to try and bring together experts in the key fields, sort of anthropology, neurology, pharmacology, maybe psychology, where I think the evidence already exists. As I was saying earlier, it would be crazy to make a claim like this if there weren't an abundance of evidence, and I think the evidence is there. So the idea is to get some of these people talking to each other. I've had a lot of correspondence over the years, and currently with some of the most respected academics in their particular field, but typically I'll get the response. I mean, I was contacting some neuroscientists this week, and they're quite well known. They're sort of considered high flyers, if you like, and I ran by some of the basic elements, and it was something that had never occurred to them, the sort of the history of how the brain developed and the influences, and obviously they're looking into that now, and the idea is to bring some of these people together to compare notes and, well, you know, does this fit? Is it possible that actually the way our left brain develops now isn't the product of specialized adaptation, as some people suggest, but it's a neurodegenerative condition where it fails to develop because we've lost these chemicals. So, yeah, that's the idea, is to put on this symposium later in the year, and I'm talking to people all the time, and the interest is developing week by week. So I'm hoping we can get together and at least discuss this and see what comes out of it.
One thing that comes to mind right now is that if it was just all dysfunctional, wouldn't have evolution have knocked us out? In other words, the what's happened in the left brain hasn't necessarily been bad for the species. I mean, there's 6 billion of us now.
Well, if you look at it through the sort of very narrow lens of competition and the way Darwin's theory is usually interpreted, which isn't the whole picture, yes, we've survived remarkably well, although we seem to have come quite close on occasions to annihilating ourselves, and that doesn't seem to be off the agenda yet, so I question the success of that. But yes, on purely a numbers game, remarkable, although where it's going to end up, you know, can we sustain 8, 12, 15 billion? I don't know. I mean, some people suggest not. But that's not really the point I'm interested in. It's a quality of life, not merely survival. I think even in Western culture, where we're told we've got it really good, you know, we've got endemic depression, and most people seem to be running around in circles just to stay afloat. So I question whether we really have cracked it, as it were, whether the effects have been beneficial or whether we just kid ourselves, whether that's part of the problem.
I guess another thing is, you've got a theory, and it's a theory now that you've had for a while. Mm. Is it possible to test it?
Yeah, I think it is. This is something that I was keen on from the earliest days, putting together a sort of a theory that was understandable in modern scientific language and was testable, because that's obviously one of the holy grails of modern science. You have to be able to test it. And there's work going on in Australia, a place called the Centre for the Mind, where they're running sort of experiments where they use a non-invasive magnetic field to switch off parts of the brain, and they found that if they switch off parts of the left hemisphere, it enhances abilities classically associated with prodigies and autistic savants, a sort of artistic ability, mathematics, this kind of thing. So there's equipment around now that we can shut off some or even all of the left side of the brain. Of course, that's not being done at the moment, because the presumption is it's there for a reason, it's doing its job, which is the standard theory. But it wouldn't be so difficult to reconfigure the experiments and take individuals who've done the necessary preparation, significant shift in diet, something approximating our primate past.
Yes, because I remember reading about some experiments attempting to isolate parts of the mind or yeah. parts of the brain and seeing what happens if you switch off certain bits of the left hemisphere. Mm. But what about testing that part of your theory which tries to explain how the brain became the way it is? In other words, doing some kind of diet testing.
Yeah, that could certainly be done as well. I think there's a couple of things come to mind. There's one, when we're talking about testing, I mean, one thing, and it's a sort of very generalized term, but modern science seems to have failed in testing the one piece of equipment it uses, our only instrument of scientific inquiry, and everything else is our mind, is our brain. It designs the experiments, it interprets the data, and that's one thing that modern science has presumed is working, which is, of course, as I'm sure you know, is bad science. We should have at least checked the equipment before we started using it. And that's never been done, to the best of my knowledge. So I'd actually lay the gauntlet down and say, hang on a minute, you know, we're presuming our neural system is functional here. That's bad science, as far as I understand. However, going beyond that, yes, back to the earlier part of the discussion, talking about these endocrine disruptors, these chemicals that change the way our hormones work, very, very powerful, considered a threat during fetal development. There's been research in using soya products, this kind of thing, and yet related to those chemicals in our past, they were incredibly abundant. They were there all the time. So in principle, there must have been an effect. The question is, yeah, can we test it? But what the effect? What would the effect have been if we had thousands of these complex chemicals running through our system from conception, literally, because they cross into the developmental environment, affecting the way the DNA was read, affecting the way the brain was built? And remember, we've got this mystery as to why the primate brain generally is so big and why the human brain went completely crazy and was accelerating. So I think all these elements are there to be looked at and trying to come up with a simple solution. And I'd suggest this is a simple solution. But yes, it's testable. Of course, we can change our diet and then we can run some experiments and that's what I tried to do in Manchester University in 1998. As far as I'm aware, every experiment ever done on humans, you know, voluntarily, I'm talking, presumes that our diet doesn't make much difference, or if it does, the diet we eat is fine. Whereas if you put primate research together with neurological testing, so we eat a diet similar to our primates, we might get different results. It's, you know, it's a standard engineering sort of approach. You change one parameter and see what happens. That's, again, that's never been done.
Since we last spoke, what's been the response to your ideas?
Shockingly good. Scarily good, actually. It's one thing when you live in a little bubble and you think, well, yeah, these ideas, pretty astounding, pretty amazing, but they might be wrong. Who's going to take any notice of them? But as time's gone on, and particularly in the last year or two, since it was all pulled together in the book, and I've been sending the book out to all sorts of academics, I've approached people who I thought would really find holes in it quickly, because obviously I'd like to know that as well. And I would have been happy with this sort of, well, you know, this is interesting, it might be worth a look at. But the response I've got, and I think you might have seen some of the comments and endorsements, has been superlative, really. It's sort of, you know, oh my God, this actually makes sense of all the anomalies and so on. So that's the typical response from academics and intelligent lay readers right the way through. So, yeah, the response has been exceptionally good when you consider how conservative the academic system usually is. To take a theory as potentially important as this from a non-academic living in the far southwest of England, and yet the comments are what they are, you know, they're there to see on the website. And
I assume you sent a copy of your book to Jill Bolte-Taylor?
Yes, I have.
And what was her response?
I don't know if she's read it yet. She basically said she had about 60 books to get through. I think since she did her YouTube talk, she became, you know, an overnight phenomenon.
She did. I mean, she was on the radio here as well as many countries.
Of course, overwhelmed with emails and all sorts of things and all sorts of books and so on. So I'm not sure she's read the book. We've had a little bit of discussion and, you know, to be perfectly honest, her take still is, oh, well, you know, my experience reinforces the idea that, yes, the right hemisphere is a repository of all this amazing stuff. I mean, quite why we can't access it is a peculiar question in my mind. Whereas the left hemisphere does all these sort of rational, practical things. And I totally agree, that is the way it is at the minute. But what she hadn't done, and what nobody else has really done, is consider the operating requirements in an evolutionary context. If, you know, it's this, I think I've used this rather crude analogy before, if you were to drag a hand-built Italian sports car out of a pond, you'd be considered a total nutter if you didn't take it a bit, strip it down, rebuild it, and then try and drive it around the track. we don't do that with the human brain, and it's infinitely more complex. We just presume that in its current state, we should get it to work.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, you know. It's,
well, there is another way of looking at it, Tony, and which is, okay, and you can show some compelling evidence that there's this brilliance in the right side of our brains.
Yeah.
And it could be locked down by the left. But I'm just wondering whether you've attempted to explain from a different perspective why it might be dangerous for us to be too brilliant, evolution in an evolutionary sense. If we were too brilliant, would perhaps we struggle to be focused? Would we end up being Tucker for all those other animals out there in the forest?
I think it's a fair point, and it does come up from time to time, and my answer is no. I think the function I'm particularly interested in, yes, the brilliance, and that's something that's easy to sell to the rational mind at the moment.
Yes, it is, yeah.
I'm more interested in the psychology behind that and the glimpses that come out of the combination of prodigy and, let's say, the mystic tradition, where you tie together a sane way of looking at the world, rather than what we seem to do now, with an ability to make the best of rational focus look like incredibly clumsy. And there are, you know, people do get glimpses of that where it's not a trade-off, and the very fact that exists at all should alert us to something. I mean, how on earth could that evolve where there are people who are not just twice as good as average, but 100 times better than average in being able to do things that are normally considered rational, and they're clearly drawing on something else? You know, it's almost a sort of semi-mystical state they describe when they access these abilities. And that includes physical abilities as well. You know, the athletes that come in, you know, they have these once-in-a-lifetime experiences that they often talk about them as if time stood still. It was dreamlike. I felt like I was out of my body and so on, and zoom, off they go.
Yeah, well, that's been another thing that's been in the news recently in New Zealand, is people who talk about having a companion when they are in really desperate situations of survival, and they get a sense that there is somebody else there with them who guides them through, and they're convinced that there's somebody else there. And that sounds, again, like another right brain sort of thing, doesn't it?
Well, that's how I would interpret it, and I don't think I'm alone in doing that. I mean, you know, people have many interpretations. I'm looking for the common denominators that repeatedly explain the anomalies. And, I think that's quite common where people are under stress for whatever reason, whether it be long periods of stress or a sudden catastrophe, an accident, where something happens and they talk in the language you've just suggested. You know, they weren't aware of what they were doing. It was like someone else was guiding them and so on. Phenomenal strength, a focus of mind and ability to get the job done. And back to your earlier point, I'd say these are the things that are really latent. It's not some out-of-focus, fluffy, well, I feel good, but I can't do anything. I think that's a sort of transitionary stage where you're partly out of one camp but not fully in the other. If you can fully engage, then everything works 100 times better. And if that doesn't interest people, then I think we're in dire straits.
Yeah. Have your theories, your ideas changed at all in the 2 years or so that we've spoken, since we've spoken?
No. The basic theory's been there, as I say, for more than 10 years now. It's been trying to communicate and get the interest and endorsement, which is building. But now, I mean, all that's really happened is more and more evidence has started to accumulate. Either there have been new experiments, or there's bits of data I didn't come across in originally, sort of archived away, that's been digitized since 1998 or so on. And I'd say the case is building all the time.
There was another thing I asked you 2 years ago, and I'd like to hear your opinion now, 2 years on, which was whether what's happened with the left side of our brain is not the result of diet, but the result of how we use our brains. And the result of, for example, technology, the development of language, of writing, of printing, of time, of our Western concepts of time, which allow us to plan for the future, think and remember the past, and therefore get more and more out of the present, which is useful for planning, but maybe means that the left side of this rational side ends up dominating, rather than diet being the cause of what you think has happened.
I'd say it's back to front. Well, first of all, the presumption that, let's say, the right side of our brain, or just to be totally clear on this, the functional left side, remember, I'm not saying there was disparity in function. I'd say the left was as good as the right at one time.
Right, yes.
It's a degenerate version of the right, so just to clear that up now. But the presumption that a functional brain or the right side of a brain couldn't do all these things a lot better would negate that in principle. But I'd certainly accept that as this balance has shifted and our society slowly reflected that, so as you point out, we've become more dependent on concepts and ideas, symbolism, writing. Our education system reflects how we take young people and immerse them in rational culture from very early and tend not to value their innate access to the right hemisphere, where they're more imaginative, they're more creative and so on. So I think the point I'm making is, yes, I think it's accelerated that process, but I don't think it's the cause. I think the causality is the change in structure, and that the loss of ability has forced the left hemisphere to rely on concepts, ideas of reality. There's a paradox where it seems to make sense to the left hemisphere. I mean, that's a classic sort of, I wouldn't say a definition of delusion, but it's part of what goes on when you're deluded. It seems to make sense. It does seem to make sense. You have to step right out of it and try and look at it from a totally different context to see, well, okay, so how does making a concept work better than actually knowing it inherently? We know these things in this other state, or we have to build models. Which one's more efficient? Why do we have to build all these models to tell us what we already know?
How have your own life practices changed in the last few years? Have they changed because of the ideas you've developed?
Not so much in the last couple of years. If anything, I've kind of, well, I'd say longer than 2 years, probably the last 5 or 6 years, I've mostly spent trying to figure out how to communicate this in an effective way, bearing in mind the paradoxes. I'm trying to convince the establishment and pretty much everybody else that there's a problem here that we're not even aware of yet, and we wouldn't be aware of. So that's quite a challenge. How do you present that in a language, in a left-brain language, that the left brain can understand?
Without people saying, this guy's a loon.
Exactly, yeah. And as I say, it's quite a challenge. I don't know whether I've pulled it off yet or not. But it's looking, as I say, it's looking promising. But no, I mean, that's been my focus for quite a few years now, including compiling the notes and then writing up the book and so on, and then approaching the academics and so on. So that's been my primary focus. And I mean, I've maintained a raw diet, but I don't spend anything like the time I used to in those experimental states, which is a great shame because they're an awful lot of fun. But I just haven't really had the time. And some of the things I end up doing, sitting on the computer all day, to be quite honest, in those more right hemisphere states, if you like, it becomes even more tedious. I'm better off if I numb my brain down a bit to get on with some rather tedious jobs, which is to do with communicating and to do with presenting this in a way that the rational mind understands. So that's really the focus for the last few years, and still is.
And in terms of getting people in, I guess, the scientific establishment thinking about what you're thinking, or at least taking it seriously, trying it on, how are you going? What's the next step likely to be?
Well, like I was saying earlier, it's going remarkably well. I mean, I sometimes feel on a very personal level, this has been going on for about 150 years. It's been quite a challenge in some ways. It's been, you know, without resources, without finance and so on. So that can be quite a big struggle. And because it's so unexpected, I think, it can easily fly straight over people's heads. It's just not on the agenda, you know. A lot of the academics will be looking for variants on theories or something that's a little bit different, and this tends to drive a truck right through the foundation of everything that's already accepted. So I think that's part of the challenge. And the history of new ideas suggests that, you know, you typically die in poverty and your great-grandchildren reap the benefits. But I'm far too stubborn to let that happen. So I've written to hundreds and hundreds of people, and interestingly enough, I'd say it's the sharpest of the academics who get this quickly. And once they do, once they've adjusted their expectations, the support, as I say, is building quite well. I said I'm impatient. I'd like it to be done tomorrow, but it's an ongoing process. But the reaction, as I say, the reaction's there on the website. It's there for anybody to see, and it's building. It's looking very good.
It's great to talk to you again, Tony. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks very much.
Tony Wright, continuing to campaign for our right brains and our brains in general. And by the way, his website, if you'd like to check it out, Left in the Dark, all one word, leftinthedark.org.uk.
While the ideas of Tony Wright continue to fascinate me, I don't know quite what to make of them, but I have made a conscious effort to eat more fruit since episode 652. Now, in a low-energy world with less food miles, we're going to have more locally produced food. Where's that going to be possible in a city? If you've got ground, then a fruit tree might be one of the most efficient ways. It's certainly more efficient than annual crops, because although it takes some time to start to bear fruit, then if it's been well looked after to begin with, then it'll last for years or decades and continue to give fruit. I like the taste of fruit. It's nutritious and is intriguing that Tony Wright suggests that was our original diet. So we might be functioning in a better fashion, we could have a better brain chemistry if we ate a lot more fruit. Now, this morning I heard an idea about opposing police violence with demonstrators in the Ukraine started to hold up mirrors to the police. I've seen thousands of demonstrators peacefully protesting being violently assaulted by police for over a decade. I think the first time I saw it was the FTAA demonstrations in Florida, and I've never seen anybody hold a mirror up, but it seems to be quite effective. There's talk of the government trying to ban mirrors because of the effect it's having on the morale of those policemen who, underneath all the riot gear, the helmets, the guns, etc., is still a human being and not particularly proud that they go into battle against ordinary people who are unarmed. A remarkably simple idea for opposing the Leviathan. And isn't it amazing how many years nobody's come up with that? Or maybe the story of the Medusa somehow relates to that, and over the intervening millennia, we've forgotten what it's about. You can read that and say, well, that just demonstrates how conditioned and stupid people are if it took them that long to come up with the idea. Or you can read it and say, well, that just shows how many ideas there could be out there which don't take lots of resources and effort, but which could help to bring about a better world. I, of course, would like that second interpretation, and Tony Wright's ideas, if there's a chance we can actually improve the functioning of our brains by a measure as simple as eating more fruit. Well, this is something that we should know about. There are fruitarians out there. I wonder what they have to say about this. The more I've looked into mental health, the more I've come to the conclusion that, like schooling or law and order, the security industry, it's a counterproductive institution. I wonder if the world is ready for an idea which would only be counterintuitive to those schooled on the drugs for broken brains approach. How about if there's an epidemic of depression, a mass campaign to try and make the world a less depressing place? We could, for example, stop doing boring jobs in offices, possibly do something else like mass plantation of fruit trees near where we live, not necessarily out of fear that suddenly food might fail to be available in supermarkets, that money might just stop working like that. Possibly just as a step in the right direction, whatever happens. If one day we find as plentiful food is available, we might find, for example, that people didn't want to buy food from supermarkets, and the office and factory workers, who weren't really interested in being office and factory workers, gave up going to the office and the factory. We might find that a lot of offices and business failed as a result, that a lot of people went bankrupt and had no money. We might find that a lot of landlords, rather than kick people out because they didn't have any money to pay, were glad to have somebody in the building with a lot of time on their hands to help pick the fruit, mend the buildings, or do whatever else was needed. And perhaps all of this could be done, not in secret and furtively, but in plain sight, in front of the Medusa, sorry, the Leviathan, whilst pointing out to a lot of highly stressed out people in so-called positions of power, look, this is a good thing to do. The world works better for everybody like this. Now, possibly that strikes you as too idealistic, but is it really? Well, we won't know unless we try, will we?
Rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me.
If you'd like to download this or any of our previous shows, you can do so from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguest.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. We have a mailing list if you're interested to contribute content, or if you broadcast the show, you're encouraged to subscribe at altruists.org/unwelcome. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I've had an internet disruption lately, so I'm on my backup internet line, but I hope that will be sorted soon. If people have been questioning your sanity lately, well, I'd encourage you to question theirs, and if you suspect that the world has gone mad, then I would tempt you to agree with you. But perhaps there's some very simple ideas out there which will help get things straight. And nowadays, good ideas can spread very fast.